in Belfast, in Londonderry, they're called the IRA. In the Philippines, they're called the Hucks. In Uruguay, in the Argentine, they're called the Tupamaro. Quebec, they're called the PLF. Syria, Lebanon, and Egypt, they're called the Black September Group, the Popular Front. In Chicago, they're called the Weathermen, or the Die Mau Mau. In West Germany, they're called the Biden-Meinhof Group. In Japan, they're called the Rengo Chikigen. What they deal in is disparate groups from many parts of the world, kidnapping, bombing, terrorism, terrare, a Latin word which means frightened. They have frightened a good part of the civilized world. But we really do not know how to deal with violence which erupts suddenly out of the dark, disappears into the dark. A wave of bombings and violence has swept across the free world, half free world. We're troubled, disturbed, not sure what to do. I'd like to address myself this morning to our understanding of this phenomenon, of this social pathology, because we're going to be called to deal with it. Unfortunately, it's here to stay. It's part of the turbulence of modern life. And I'm afraid that sweet reason, the instinctive response of decent folk, not always adequate to comprehend, to understand this demonology. But we deal here with the dark spaces of the soul, that parts of the human psyche, of certain human psyches, which do not show themselves to be amenable to reason or to understanding or to any efforts or for social reform. And I would take as my jumping off point this morning an article which was written by Tom Wicker just 2 days after the most headlined of all of the spate of terrorist acts this year, the holding of Israeli hostages in the Olympic Village in Munich, then the shooting of the hostages and those who held them at the Munich airport. Tom Wicker is a man whose compassion and whose sensitivity I have great respect for. I suspect that his reactions mirror those of many, and I believe his reactions to have been wrong, misleading. And I would like to argue with them, and hopefully in that argument, show you how I think we can understand this phenomenon of violence. Wicker said in this article called The Seeds of Terrorism that he, of course, deplored and was saddened by and shocked by the reprehensible violence of the Olympic Games, as we all were. And his shock and his sadness and his feeling of moral outrage are honest and genuine, as ours was. But then he continues, and this is the first of 2 points at which I take issue with him. Even those who most strongly condemn the Arabs who precipitated the incident can hardly be satisfied with the outcome apparently precipitated by the West German police in the airport shootout. Early reports at least raised the question whether the death of the hostages was worth the killing and worth the apprehension of the terrorists. where the best resolution of the problem was a violent showdown, rather than continuing every feasible effort to negotiate the hostages' release. This is the same question raised by the death of so many prisoners and hostages in a hail of New York State police gunfire at Attica, a tragedy the anniversary of which will fall just next week. It is his feeling that we ought, whenever possible, to bend to the demands of the terrorist, of those who use violence to achieve their ends. And that it is a tragedy, as a tragedy undoubtedly it is, that innocents, people who simply happen to be caught up in the net of violence, should have to pay with their lives for the intransigence of governments or of authorities in not giving in to the demands which are placed upon them. And I'd like to return to that point, for I disagree with it fundamentally. But then Wicker goes on to say that obviously efforts must be made to deny to the hostages places of safety, where they will be coddled, where they can regroup, where they can arm themselves and train themselves in arms and the use of arms. And he then speaks of the manifest difficulty of persuading the Arab governments to deny such centers to the camps, to the terrorists, for political reasons, because of their popularity in the Arab world, or because the Arab governments find them a useful and convenient tool for certain policies of their own. Of course, that's true. And then he goes on to speak of the difficulty of imposing international sanctions on governments which harbor the terrorists, because many governments have groups which are believed to be terrorists by other governments. Because given the tensions which exist in the world today, international sanctions simply do not work, cannot successfully be imposed. And of course, this is true. But the conclusion of his analysis is the second point with which I disagree. Tom Wicker wrote, "So it is a good deal easier to call for something to be done than to say what that something should be. Defensive measures such as those President Nixon has pledged for Israelis traveling in America are certainly necessary. West German security provisions at the Olympic Village appear in the first reports to have been sketchy at best. But no adequate defenses can be erected that will always thwart fanatic terrorists willing to die for their cause. That is the heart of the matter. Whether it is the strange mixture of religious and political animosities in Ireland, or radical Americans bombing banks and university buildings to bring down the system, or obscure tribes slaughtering one another for obscure to outsider reasons in Africa, or Palestinians acting by any means to recover a homeland they see as stolen, profound religious, political, and racial fates can stir men and women through the most unreasoning pitches of action and response. When such people will not hesitate to die for their beliefs, however strange or distorted those beliefs may seem to others, they will seldom hesitate to take the most drastic and outrageous actions to defeat those who stand in the way. The cause justifies any and everything. Ultimately, the cause consumes common humanity. That is why the only thing finally to be done to end Palestinian terrorism is to find some means of resolving the profound conflict that produces it." Now, obviously, the conflict between Israel and the Arab world ought to be resolved. But what I question the very basis of the root of the argument, is that the resolution of this conflict between Palestinians and Israelis will in any way reduce the level of terrorism in our world. Now, let's examine these points one by one. Mr. Wicker's first point is that we ought to do everything possible to avoid the death by violence of the innocents who are suddenly caught in some flare-up of terrorism. And obviously, within reason, this should be done. And his point of view is that of most Americans. We've had to deal with terrorism really largely in terms of skyjacking. And it was far easier for us to give the skyjacker $500,000 and the plane and send him to Algeria knowing that the Algerian government would the next day return the plane and a few days later would return the money, and nothing seemingly would be lost. But I suspect that far more than most of us are willing to acknowledge, the fact that every time we now go down to New York for a day's work, every article of handbag that we carry aboard is searched, that the spate of hijacking is directly due to the success of the hijackers. That if we had taken some kind of repressive measure to not to allow these men to leave the country, to find some kind of security, more importantly, not have given them the notoriety which comes with success, the headlines by which they live, the rash of skyjacking which has plagued the airlines of this country and the world might have been diminished quite a bit long since. For these men are little men who desperately need to be seen, to be acknowledged, to wield power. It's that one moment of power, that elation, which they seek. And it's the success of another skyjacker which gives them the courage to try. And of course, when America was faced with uprisings in our prisons, terrorist uprisings, and when the demand in the prisons, as it was in Washington 2 weeks ago, was not only for prison reform, but to immediate freedom for the prisoners, we couldn't give in either. For that is simply to exchange one set of innocent victims for another set of innocent victims. When you have men who are known to be violent, who do not have the same kind of conscience which the ordinary person in society does, who have a kind of anger which flashes out, who are in prison because they committed acts of violence, you would free them. Yes, you might release the warden and the guards who were imprisoned that day in the prison, but how many innocent people would suddenly be subjected to attack on the streets because those men had been released to the streets? And was that not, in fact, the kind of judgment which the Israeli government had to make? For was not the demand in Munich that 200 men who had committed acts of violence against Israel be released from Israeli prisons? And what would Israel have gained by releasing these 200 plus men of terror? The release of 8 lives in Munich? Yes. But how many more innocent lives would have been lost because these men would again have guns in their hand, and because these men would know that if they are captured, and many of them had murdered before they were captured, Israel has no capital punishment even for these crimes, unfortunately, that they would be released soon by some other conquest of conquering, of taking of innocent people. The game would go on and go on and go on, and there was little cost, little danger to them. That's the kind of decision that the Israeli government faced, and the reason for its intransigence, for which men of sweet reason who really do not think through the cold realities of pathology have faulted the country. Should she exchange these lives for these lives? Which decision would you have made? Some years ago, 1970, the FLQ, the Front for the Liberation of Quebec, you may recall, kidnapped a British trade official, the name of Mr. Cross, and the Quebec Minister of Labor, Monsieur Laporte. And they held these men outside of Quebec City for several weeks. And they demanded great sums of money, and they demanded the separation of Quebec from Canada, and made great headlines, as you'll recall. And during that particular incident, the London Economist published an analysis of the situation, which, since it does not deal with Israel and the Arab world, with things of immediate emotional concern to us, it deals rather with an issue which we can look at with some dispassion, I think, bears within it understanding and awareness that we ought to take to heart. What has happened in Montreal, and is happening a lot of other places too, is the increasingly indiscriminate use of violence for the sake of increasingly imprecise political objectives. It is the uncontrolled in pursuit of the undefined. The other word for it, of course, is terrorism. The terrorists are the people who reject the idea that it should be possible to set some limits on the use of force in setting political quarrels. Men have spent a great deal of time in history trying to impose such limits. The limits have never been accepted by everyone, and they have often been violated. But they have done something to make life a little less anarchic. One such rule of the thumb was the notion that there ought to be a clear connection between the grievance that makes people resort to violence and the targets of their violence. That is why feudal theoreticians said that single combat was a suitable way of settling the thing, and why, when that had long since failed to catch on, the 18th century tried to confine war to a test of strength between uniformed armies, and why, when that failed too, it was least thought proper to make a declaration of war against the people you were supposed to have it out with. The technique of the terrorist snaps the last constraint. The people a terrorist kills or threatens to kill if his demands are not met are more or less random victims. Their chief qualification for being selected is that they can be gotten at. It is not only the Canadian government that finds itself stuck for an answer to the anybody is fair prey game. There are half a dozen Latin American countries where left-wing revolutionaries and right-wing counter-terrorists have polished the trick of whipping the man off the payment, remember the murdered German ambassador in Guatemala, and disappearing with him into some undefinable hideout in the city. The Palestinian hijackers go about their work in a different way, but the aim is the same. To get control of an airliner full of people who have nothing to do with the Palestinians' quarrel with Israel, and threaten to blow them to pieces unless their governments do that which the hijackers say. So far, the Weathermen and the Black Panthers have not pulled off a political kidnapping in the United States, but it will be surprising if they do not try. The Black Panthers have the same immediate aim as the Palestinians and the FLQ, the release of friends held in prison for previous acts of violence. And they can see the advantage of an operation that promises to make a sentence of imprisonment more or less a formality. There are men in Ulster and Dublin and other places who have similar motives and who can make the same calculation. The cabinet minister and ambassador will fetch a fine price. If you can't get one of those, a mayor or a businessman will do very nicely. And even if that is beyond your reach, you can play on the heartstrings of public opinion with anybody who has a family and friends who want to see him whole again. There must be a lot of men around the world who have noted the Palestinian success and the cat-and-mouse game in Montreal, and feel the temptation to copy the examples that have been given to them. It is tempting because it is the cheapest known way of enforcing your political ideas, and because, so far, it has worked. The only thing you need for a successful campaign of modern terrorism are a handful of brave or unfeeling toughs organized in tiny squads operating almost independently of each other, a few cupboards of small arms and explosives, and somewhere to hold your captives when you've got hold of them. There is no shortage of necessary fanatics, desperate, obsessed, or unbalanced men, encouraged by the rhetoric of the new left and the trendy talk about violence being a form of communication. There are enough guns on the market in the world to equip an army corps of guerrillas. The warren of a modern Western city where the police keep order in the streets but have got out of the habit of poking into people's houses is a fine place to hide people. That is why in the West terrorism has come out of the country into the cities. The country is too easy to keep an eye on. And once the hostage has been grabbed, the guerrilla knows that the television and the newspapers will do the rest of the job for them, provided they remain uncaught. The motives of the people who practice urban guerrilla war are as much a psychological problem as a political one. But the things that make it possible for them to operate, the weapons, the environment, the publicity, are what a liberal society has given them. And of course, the result will be a curtailment of some of the advantages of living in a liberal society. But sometimes the precautions will fail to work. The hostage will be taken, and the dance of negotiators will begin all over again. It is necessary to say a hard thing about what may have to happen then. There is nothing a minister fears more than the moment when a man's life or death depends on his decision. The instinct is always to give in to the kidnappers or the hijackers and get the hostages out, and then hope faintly that it won't happen again. But the odds are that it will. It is success, not failure, that breeds imitation. The act of terrorism which succeeds in getting convicted men released from prison or brings in a pot of ransom money is providing new resources for future acts of terrorism. There will come a point, it may have come already, when the probable death of one or two men has to be reckoned against the likelihood that a lot more people will face the same threat if the government gives in. Of course, the kidnappers may not carry out their threat if they are defied. Defying them is something that very few governments have yet the nerve to try. It has to be tried. This is, after all, a kind of war. And in war, every decision is a calculation or a hope that life lost now will prevent a greater number of lives being lost later. And that's the kind of hard decision that the Israeli government, almost alone among the governments of the world, has found itself forced to make. Few lives now, danger to the passenger on a plane when there is a shootout with a skyjacker, danger to its Olympians when it's a matter of protecting those back home from a company of guerrillas who would again be released for their murderous undertaking. And I'll tell you an interesting fact. Israel seems to have thrown the fear of its arms and of its retaliation into the hearts of these great men of great courage who shoot from the dark with masks over their faces. The interesting fact is that very few acts of terrorism against Israel in Israel have been carried out by Arabs. More and more they've had to resort to dupes, the foolish, to the disturbed of the world. Did you see the little article in the paper on Friday, I guess the last day we had a morning newspaper? It told of a man by the name of Guy Bouchard. You don't know the name, I don't know who the man is. But Guy Bouchard is an unemployed Frenchman who had worked once for Air France. And apparently he has some kind of argument with Air France. And he was asked or bought by some Arabs to take a bomb and to place it at Orly next to the counter of the plane that would be flying to Israel. Now, Guy Bouchard is unemployed. The money is attractive. He has a grudge. He has nothing to do with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. He couldn't tell a Palestinian from an Israeli if you put them in front of him. But what does this great hero do? He finds a girl who's in love with him, and he gives the bomb to the girl, and he tells the girl, you go plant the bomb. Such things, crusades of terror, are made. And the two great catches of those who were planting explosives on airlines made by the Israelis in the last year have both involved simple-minded girls, two French girls, two Italian girls, who were picked off the streets of Paris and of Rome by Arab gigolos and bedded down for a while, and then given plane tickets to Lida and asked if they wouldn't carry this case or this transistor radio filled with explosives onto the plane. Somehow the language of fear has translated itself to the Black September group. And they know that their lives are at stake if they perform certain acts of terror against Israel, so they resort to these kinds of courageous means to do their work. I doubt that any other way of dealing with terrorism but to attempt to suppress it, to punish those who engage in it, not to give in to it, any other way has any chance of staunching the rise of this kind of violence in our world. It will not do away with it. Oppression has never destroyed crime, but it may limit it. Because the disturbed, those who want their moment in the sunlight, don't want that moment to be in the grave. They want to live to enjoy it. Now, what about Mr. Wicker's second contention? The contention that somehow eliminating the causes of terror will eliminate the terrorism itself. I suspect that this argument comes from a good heart. And it's obviously true that if we could remove a number of the social conflicts in this world, we would make a contribution to peace in our time. But I doubt that we would make a contribution to the elimination of terrorism, which is not synonymous with the cause of peace. Terrorism does not come simply because we do not have a world where the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has not been solved. As a matter of fact, the Popular Front and the Black September group have very little to do with the Palestinian cause. Those who held the hostages in Munich were not Palestinians. A search of their background has shown that they came from Iraq, they came from Syria, they came from Kuwait, they came from Algeria, they were buried in Libya. They were not Palestinians. As a matter of fact, the Palestinians who do have some very legitimate needs in this world for a certain degree of sovereignty, for a certain degree of security, which they do not now enjoy, have rejected again and again the kind of terrorist acts which these groups have undertaken. For these groups are out after Arab governments who do not suit their needs. These groups are out to overthrow Jordan, to overthrow Syria, to overthrow Lebanon, to establish power bases for a new kind of radical revolutionary Arab government which is to their liking. And most of the pressure of these Arab terrorists has been directed to overthrow Hussein, who had to fight a civil war to get them out of his country. And the Egyptians who use the Popular Front for their own purposes have seen to it that they cannot operate in any kind of field way, that there are no terrorist camps in Egypt. They're a threat to the Arab world, to the established governments of the Arab world, far more than they are a threat to Israel. As a matter of fact, they use the Israeli cause only to give them a certain kind of credibility in this world. It's a way of attracting support. And one of the things I think we must do is to recognize that those who attach themselves in a terroristic way to social problems, to this cause or that, are really not concerned, for the most part, with the success of those causes. They're a means to an end, a means to power, a means to the headline, a means of coming up from the underworld where I'm unknown and repressed, into the world where I walk strong and where the gun that I hold or the grenade that I hold gives me power over other men. Americans, unfortunately, have a rather romantic view of violence. It comes from the movies, perhaps it comes from our past. Whatever it comes from, we tend to assume that there's some cause behind the violence. And so when President Kennedy was assassinated, we had a Warren Commission, which met in deliberation for months on end to try and discover why Lee Harvey Oswald murdered the President of the United States. We looked for a left-wing conspiracy, we looked for a right-wing conspiracy, we looked for any kind of conspiracy. There had to be a cause. And the result was the psychiatric result. There was no cause except Lee Harvey Oswald's own frustrations. He was a little man. He wanted to be known. He was an insignificant man, and he wanted to shake the world. With a gun, a little man, an insignificant man, the guns pointed at a significant man, a powerful man, can shake the world. And when Martin Luther King was assassinated, again we looked to his assassin for some kind of cause. Racist cause. He thought perhaps he'd been paid by racists. And again, all we found in James Earl Ray was a little man, an unsuccessful convict, felon, criminal, who again needed his moment in the sun. When the psychiatrists are through analyzing the man who shot at Governor Wallace, they're going to find the exact same kind of human pathology. For the men of violence, the assassins and the terrorists of our world are men who are desperate for being seen and being known and being acknowledged, being loved, being accepted, proving they need to prove again and again their manhood. And so they clamp on to some man of power or to some cause, and they try and gain power, gain acceptance by drawing to themselves the mantle of a crusader, the mantle of a holy cause. Nowhere is this seen more clearly than in the violence, the terrorism that occurred at Lita Airport in June of last year. It was Air France's Flight 132. It landed with some 300 passengers aboard. Passengers had disembarked and they were standing around the shed at Lita, waiting for the conveyor belts to bring in their baggage, taking off their baggage, carrying it to the customs counter where it could be checked out. And there were three young Japanese aboard this plane. No one paid very much attention to them, and they stood in line patiently for their luggage, and then they bent down as if to loosen the strap so that it could go through customs. And suddenly they stood up, and each of them had in his hand a VKT-58, an automatic rifle. And they began shooting. Before the carnage had subsided and was silenced, there were 28 dead. Two of the terrorists, 16 Puerto Rican Catholics who were on a pilgrimage to the Holy Land, a number of other people who simply happened to be around the shed at that moment. Now, what had three Japanese to do with Israel, with the Palestinian cause? Immediately, the media in the United States spoke of a new kind of combination between all the radical movements of the world in which each would carry out the job of the other because they were basically sympathetic to each other's needs. But one of the Japanese had survived, a young man named Kogo Okamoto. And at his trial, he made a confession, a statement. He spoke of belonging to the Red Army in Japan, a group of young Japanese who have taken the old samurai tradition and wedded it somehow to the theory of permanent revolution and come out with a kind of radicalism which insists that the world must be turned over and turned over and turned over again, that there must be class war and class war, and ultimately out of the final carnage will emerge a new society. And I want to read to you what he said in this statement, because it suggests to me that there is no way in which the solution of the Palestinian cause, quotation marks, will contribute to the elimination of this kind of violence. He said, "You're either a member of the Red Army or a bourgeois. I warn the entire world, the Red Army will slay anyone who is on the side of the bourgeois, and this is not a joke. Our relations with the Popular Front, Arabs, was just a jumping off point for us to propel ourselves onto the world stage. This is why we decided on the military action at the Tel Aviv airport. Japanese soldiers had carried out the attack rather than Arab terrorists," he said, "because we wanted to be known. We, the Red Army soldiers who have been in the Arab world, do not demand that they be soldiers like us. We take full responsibility for the killing at the airport. The three of us decided that after we die, we want to become three stars in Orion. In Japan, little children are told that after they die, they can become stars in the sky. I don't know the customs in other parts of the world, but I believe that some of the people we killed have become stars. The Revolutionary War will continue, and there will be many more stars." He said revolutionary warfare would be worldwide. In New York and Washington, the houses of simple folk must be destroyed. That is how they would be able to feel the seeping torrent of world revolution. Now, how will Mr. Wicker's solving of the Palestinian problem solve the distorted, pathological, ideological mishmash of world revolution, of an Okamoto, and of the thousands around the world who have similar ideas to him, and who feel that the gun against innocent people is the only way to breed terror to sow the revolution? Unfortunately, when one begins to argue, as does Mr. Wicker, that the only thing finally to be done is to end Palestinian terrorism, is to find some means of resolving the profound conflict that produces it, We tend to take the problem from the where it belongs. The guilt is on the terrorist. The guilt is on the countries which sponsor terrorism and encourage it, and to put the guilt subtly but really upon the backs of Israel. Somehow Israel must do what needs to be done to defuse the conflict, and if the conflict is defused, all this will somehow disappear. That's the innocent, optimistic, American, humanistic reason. Would that it were so, but it's simply not so. Yes, there ought to be a resolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, but it will not be resolved by terrorism. Terrorism never resolves anything. It only aggravates a situation. It's ultimately counterproductive. One of the myths of the last decade or so has been that if you call enough attention to your cause, you will somehow do your cause good. Often, if you call attention to your cause, you only cause to the counterproductive forces to rally, to be even more oppressive, more reactionary, and more intransigent than they've been before. Yes, there are demonstrations which are useful. There is need to call attention to necessary change. But these useful demonstrations are almost always nonviolent, and they do not set up these kinds of bloody reverberations which force an Israel to take a retaliatory act, which lead to the war that we have in Ireland, which lead to the police attacking these kinds of people the world over. I'm afraid that we can't put the responsibility solely upon Israel to solve the problems of Arab terrorism. Be solved only when we unravel the secrets of the human mind, and we have programs of mental health which are worldwide and have some chance of success. Until then, I'm afraid that terrorism will remain with us. Terrorism will attach itself to this cause or to that, and that we had best beware, you and I, and particularly the media, of ultimately glorifying any act of terrorism by giving it the validity of the particular cause it claims it sponsors. Terrorism is murder. Nothing more, nothing better. Terrorism violates the Ten Commandments. It does not promote any cause. There is no such thing as holy terror. There's no such thing as holy rage. There's only terror and violence and the innocent victim. In the Talmud, we're told, the prophet Habakkuk once said, and it's true, that God created man as if man were a fish. In the image of the fish created he him. Why is this line in the Talmud? Because the rabbis said that just as in the sea, the larger fish swallow the smaller fish, so in human society, given man as he is, the more powerful people swallow the poorer people. And were it not for the fear of government, this process, the rule of the jungle, would be endless. And what they suggest, as a matter of fact, what our entire rabbinic tradition suggests, is that with all the limitations of government, with all the indignities of privilege and caste and class which have been built, unfortunately, into every legal system which has ever developed, governments are necessary in order to protect the innocent from the violence of the powerful, or in this case, from the violence of those who would be powerful. We have gone through several decades, you and I, in which we have learned and learned clearly the hidden violence which is within any governmental system. We've been made to recognize by a very important kind of political analysis that violence is not only the attack of the worker upon the factory where he thinks he is abused, the attack of people against privilege, the attack of people in the poor, who are poor, against those who abuse them in their communities, but it's the attack, this hidden attack of privilege against those who are poor, those who are powerless, those who are abused. And most of us, I'm afraid, have gone one step further and become pretty much disenchanted with government as an entity. We've talked about ultimate freedom. We've talked about a kind of participatory democracy in which the police and the courts and all of the oppressive systems of a society simply do not operate. We've come to feel that somehow such a society is possible. Perhaps it is. But until the Messianic Age, we're going to need police, and we're going to need sky marshals, and we're going to need government. We're going to need reform. We all need to be protected against the men who can get the guns, who can in a flash turn the guns against us. The human being has a potential within him to be godlike, but he's also a beast. And his capacity for cunning, his need of blood, his need for a moment which justifies his whole existence by the sense of power, the elation. This kind of person is among us. Perhaps he's in each of us. He's there. There is violence in our mobile society, our gun-toting society. There's a chance to be violent. I'm afraid that all of us, however much we might wish it otherwise, have need to support those elements in our repressive political structure which protect us, protect all of us from the tyranny of the few. There is the tyranny of the many, and there is the tyranny of the few. Somehow we must learn to live protected from both, to enlarge the social order, to solve the problems which are real problems, quite independent of this whole issue of violence, promote justice, economic and political justice in our world. At the same time, to protect those who travel and those who are at home, and those who suddenly invade, who demand in the name of some unholy cause the right to take a life, take a man.